Good evening and welcome to the sixth presentation, and this is our 13th season of talks on Kentucky Live, Southern Culture at its Best, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services, I coordinate this series with help from our webmaster in the back, taking pictures, Haiwan Wan, and our research instruction coordinator, Brian Carson. Ryan Dowell and Patrick Peters designed our posters. And our technical specialist tonight is Daniel Pauly. Our speaker tonight is a native of Louisville, Kentucky, where she has lived all of her life. And growing up, she was inspired by her mother, who was a teacher working on her master's degree when she was very young. And her mother taught her to read by first teaching her how to write and tell stories, a method called writing to read, which has inspired her later love of writing. She received her Master of Fine Arts in Creative Writing from Spalding University and has served as an English as a Second Language teacher, ESL, for Catholic Charities Migration and Refugee Services, Kentucky Refugee Ministries, Jefferson County Schools, and Global LT Incorporated. Her writing has appeared in the Adirondack Review, Arts Across Kentucky, Edible Kentucky, New Southerner, the Louisville Courier Journal, The Rumpus, and many more. While hosting potlucks in her ESL classes, where students would bring favorite dishes from her home countries, she first conceived of the important connection between a refugee's comfort foods and their new lives in Kentucky. Her book, Flavors from Home, Refugees Share Their Stories and Comfort Foods, published by the University Press of Kentucky in 2015, builds on that idea. One of those stories is about Mirzet Mustapic, a Bosnian refugee from Zvornik who arrived in Bowling Green in 1994. And he's here with us tonight. The book recently won the Gourmand World Cookbook Award for Best Charity and Fundraising Cookbook in the United States in 2015. She continues to teach English for several corporate clients and has been pondering a new writing project on spiritual and sacred places in Kentucky. Please welcome Amy Zering. Amy?
Thank you, Brian. Yes, it's so wonderful to be here tonight. What a great crowd. You never know. There could be just a handful of people and sometimes a wonderful crowd like this. So thank you all for coming out. I know there's a lot of things that are competing with your time and attention. So thanks for coming out and learning more about refugees here in Kentucky. I'm going to get into a little bit more about myself and the book and what inspired me to write it. But first I wanted to thank WKU Libraries, the Kentucky Live Series, and of course, Brian Coots for organizing this wonderful event. Y'all are very lucky for your town to have something like this. And I have to also thank Barnes & Noble for hosting in this great spot. And Mirzet Mustapic. Could you stand or could you just raise your hand? Mirzet is featured in my book, and I just have to thank him. He has been so gracious in sharing his story, and not just in while I was writing the book, but in the promotion after it. He's just been a wonderful resource, and I appreciate you, Mirzet, and your bravery and courage to share your story. And as Brian mentioned, Mirzet came over, one of the first Bosnians to resettle here in Bowling Green in 1994, one of the first five families, I believe. So thank you for being here tonight. Also, we have over to the side here some dessert for later, something to tempt you to stay to the finish. But they are Tulumbas, is that correct? Okay, so this is a very traditional dessert from Bosnia in that region of the world. So you'll all be able to try some of that at the end of our presentation. So thanks to Mirzet and also the Mediterranean Food Store. Who has been there here in town? Anybody? Yeah. So they both supplied this. So thank you all. I thought we would start out with a little activity. This is, what would you take in your backpack? And now generally, I you know, pass out a piece of paper that has a backpack on it. I thought I might save a few trees tonight. I didn't know what our audience numbers would be. So I just want you all to ponder this question. Say that someone tells you you have to pack a backpack, but the thing is, you don't know where you're going, you don't know for how long you'll be gone, or for what reason. So that's the difficulty in this exercise. So just take a few moments, think about it. If you do have a piece of paper, you can scribble down some ideas, and then we're going to share some ideas in just a moment. So think about it. You don't know where you're going, for how long, or for what reason. What would you pack in this backpack for a trip? All you know is that you must pack this backpack. Anybody want to volunteer an idea? What would you pack, you guys? Apples, wonderful. That sounds like a tasty treat, okay, and healthy. Who else? Toothbrush, good.
Bottled water.
What, bottled water, yes.
Knife.
Were you a Boy Scout? That's a good one. What else?
Change of clothes and a candle.
Change of clothes and a candle, was it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, good. Anybody else?
A notebook and pen. Tell my journey.
Yeah. Oh, are you a writer? That's a good idea, though. I'm surprised nobody said this. Did anybody think about this? Good. It's not easy to part with these days, is it? Anybody else want to share an idea? No? Okay. Well, if you had been a refugee, you would have had to grab whatever you could, and often with little to no time. Some common things that we see refugees bring in, money, of course, a religious symbol or holy book. That's often if they have some time to think about it first. Pictures of loved ones, few clothing items. Somebody talked about a change of clothes. But sometimes they just have the clothes on their back. And some paperwork. Sometimes they might have the marriage certificate or their educational documents, sometimes their job history. In fact, one of the Burmese men that I interviewed, he showed me, you know, his whole resume, and it actually helped him get a job because he had been a cook over in Burma. So he had, you know, was able to show what he had done in the past, and it actually helped him get a job as a cook rather easily. So those are some of the things that we often see. But the purpose of this little exercise is to kind of contrast the different cultures, and what we find important might not be in another culture. Or, you know, cell phones, toothbrushes, sometimes they don't even have that in very remote areas or poor areas. So also it's to kind of get you thinking about what you think is essential in life. Is it really? Is it truly essential? What could you live with? What could you live without? So I'd like to start out with that, just a little warm-up exercise. To give you some idea of some of the stories of the people that I had interviewed for the book about what they brought with them, I'll tell you one story about a Bhutanese man. His name is Kamala Pati Subedi, and he was one of my students. And he was a prosperous farmer and a community leader from his area in southern Bhutan, and he was from the minority ethnic group in Bhutan called the Lhasas, and they were the ones that were persecuted in the 90s and had to stay for many, many years in Nepalese refugee camps. But one night, his neighbor warned him that the army was out to get him because he, of course, being so prosperous, they targeted him first. So with no advance notice, he literally ran out with just his pajamas on. It was in the middle of the night. Had to leave his family, his wife, everything behind. He had acres and acres of land and a beautiful home. And I don't even know if he was wearing shoes. Fortunately, they lived very close to the Indian border, so he was able to go down to India, and there he had friends who kind of helped him for 6 months to a year, I believe it was, until he was able to get relocated with his family in a Nepalese refugee camp. So that's one example. I mean, he had nothing with him. Then often refugees don't know where they're going and are given very short notice. One example is a Pakistani woman named Galale Wali Khan. She's in Louisville, and she was one of the very few Pakistani surgeons, a female surgeon. She was targeted by the Taliban because her family members were involved with left-wing political party. So she was actually coming out of her medical clinic one day, and somebody on a scooter just drove by and shot at her point blank. And that was one of the first things she told me when we met. She said, "I shouldn't be alive today." It just grazed, I believe, her shoulder. And fortunately, the person was a bad shot, but she's alive to tell her story. But because she had such a high security risk in her situation, she came to America with her three boys. But she didn't know until just hours before she boarded the plane of where she was going. So she was given these travel documents, and she looked down, and she was like, "Louisville, Kentucky?" She's like, "Where the hell is Kentucky?" She had never heard of it except for, guess what?
Chicken.
Kentucky Fried Chicken, you got it. And that's the only thing she could think of. And so can you imagine if our roles had been reversed and somebody was telling us we're going to Pakistan, and she's from the Peshawar Valley. So, okay, what's the climate? Are there mountains? I mean, what? You don't know anything about that place. So it's really amazing sometimes to see how little they know about where they're going. But they are just so thankful to know that they're getting out of harm's way. And Merzett, he actually was a lawyer in Bosnia, and his wife was a physician. And they were refugees. They went over to Serbia, correct? And was it about a year you were there, or until you decided to move to the United States? A little while? First one, Schmidt. You didn't tell me that in my book. Okay. Okay, but I think you told me when you all finally made that decision to leave and to come over to the United States that they only had $200 to their name. So you can imagine from their lifestyle before and then to only leave and have to start over again with only $200 in your pocket. It's not much. So those are some examples of things that people brought with them here to America and what they had. So let me tell you a little bit about myself here, about Amy. Yes, as Brian mentioned, born and raised in Louisville. I've been an English language teacher for 7 years now, and I started out with Catholic Charities, Kentucky Refugee Ministries, and their elder program, which I love that job. I did that for about 4 years. Then I've also taught with Jefferson County Public School System at their adult ESL program. And then now, as Brian mentioned too, I am doing a lot of corporate work, and McDonald's is one of my clients now. I train them to their staff to specifically with their jobs related vocabulary. But I really find this work so rewarding. I love what I do, and I hope I can continue doing this for a long time to come. I've probably worked with immigrants from more than 25 different countries. As Brian also mentioned, I have a master's in fine arts and writing, got my BA in English and psychology at Bellarmine, and a lifetime dream here come true. I've always wanted to, even as a child, wanted to publish a book, so here we go, Flavors from Home. This kind of took a circuitous route, though, how I came to this, because in my master's in fine arts program, I studied fiction, and so, of course, this is nonfiction, and for years and years, I worked on a novel that just was going nowhere. I couldn't find an agent, and you know, you think you're following your calling in life, and I was just like, what's going on? But I got this little voice in my head that said, go out and serve your community. And I had just gotten too stuck in my own head, and I was getting depressed, so that's exactly what I did. And then I met a wonderful Bosnian, Juliana Jevarek, who introduced me to working at Catholic Charities. She was the Catholic Charities manager for their ESL school. Started to volunteer there first, and then that led to a paid position down the road. So you just never know where life is going to lead you, but it's always just important to be open to those gut instincts and those little nudges that you hear and you feel. Flavors from Home is definitely a labor of love. I was going through a very difficult time when I wrote that book, and in many ways it was my saving grace. Just being around people like Merzette, and I could see what they had been through and how they were redefining their lives and how successful they have been at it, and they do it with such grace. It really helped me know that I was going to be okay and that I too could find a new identity and start over again as well. So that's what I hope people take away. One of the things from the book is just these inspirational stories. No matter where we are in life, we probably can all relate to some point of transition where we have to redefine ourselves, recreate a new life for ourselves. And so these people give us just great motivation of how to do that and do that well. The book, as Brian mentioned, evolved out of my work teaching ESL, where we'd have these potlucks, and I would see people from all over come together around food, and I really saw how food is a universal language and how it brings people together. And it's a very non-threatening way of connecting people. That's what I love about it, as many arts are, and I believe culinary arts, of course, it's an art form. My emphasis throughout the book is on what unites people across cultures rather than what divides us. And here in this world, we're living with so much, hearing it all the time in the news about what's dividing us. I just kept coming back to this point. This is what we all have in common, and this is what can bond us. Just wanted to point out, too, I'm also the co-founder of a nonprofit, Global Commons, and what we're trying to do is bridge the local community in Louisville, in the Louisville area, with our internationals. And we're trying to do that with providing unique educational opportunities. And one of the things that we did recently, back in October on our Louisville waterfront, we had a mock refugee camp, and we gave people different identities. Were you there by chance? Or you heard about it?
I'm from Louisville.
Oh, great. Okay, well, we're having one in June, so we're all looking for volunteers already. It was just an amazing event. We had 800 students go through it, and we had different stations like the food station, and we even had a jail, and if you didn't have your proper paperwork, you were sent to jail, and it was just an eye-opening experience, and it was meant to build empathy, too, and to teach people about these different cultures, because you had to take on an identity. Okay, you're an Iraqi family. Boom, this is your name, and this is what you've gone through. So, we're having one in June to celebrate World Refugee Day. And so be looking for that, more information on that. But it's something that, as our group grows, we want to help teach others to do that in your community. And church groups are a great way to put that on. And so feel free to talk to me later about if you'd like some more information about Global Commons. Another thing we do are called Global Tables, where about four times a year we will go out to a restaurant, different ethnic restaurant there in Louisville, and we will just eat together and share stories. And the next one, I believe, is going to be in June, and it's at a Nigerian restaurant called Funmi's Cafe, and she's Nigerian, great lady. And so we're excited about that one coming up. And also just to educate people about these different cultures. So not just through the food, but also sharing stories. So be on the lookout for those things. Before switching slides, I wanted to ask you guys, it's in the news a lot, I know, but do you all know the difference between a refugee and an immigrant, or is there a difference? Does anybody want to take a stab at that? Yeah. Yes, that's part of it. Forced to flee, yes. Yeah. Let's look at this slide here. So who is a refugee? You all could read that. A refugee is someone who has been forced to flee his or her homeland because of persecution, war, or violence. A refugee has a well-founded fear of persecution for these various reasons, often race, religion, nationality, political opinion, membership in a certain social group, those kinds of reasons. And I have these pictures here because, especially now in the news, we see these kinds of images, but I also wanted to contrast this down here. We, just as Merzette and his wife are examples, we have a lot of refugees who come from very affluent backgrounds and lifestyles and who are very well educated. And a lot of people have in their mind that refugees are all, you know, poor and uneducated, and that certainly isn't so. let me go back to the immigrant to compare that to the refugee. An immigrant or economic migrant comes here to better their life, often financially, to get a better education, to help send money back home, and they're choosing to come here as opposed to the refugees who have to flee due to these a serious threat to their life. Do you all know what UNHCR is? United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, and that is the governing body to protect and support refugees. Now, this goes to show you how quickly things can change. When I wrote my book just a few years ago, we were at a little over 15 million refugees, and now you can see that we're at 19.5 million in the world. If that seems kind of low to you, it actually, if we look at the include internally displaced persons, or IDPs, there's almost 60 million. Internally displaced persons are those who had to flee their actual home but are still within their borders of their homeland. And half of all refugees are children, a very sad statistic. And, you know, I always often say to people who think, gosh, there's so many refugees coming over here. Well, if you look at this statistic, actually less than 1% of refugees are resettled in one of the countries. It's only about a dozen or so that are willing to resettle them. And all refugees, of course, come to the U.S. legally and have a passed security and very severe health screenings. I found this pie chart, thought this was interesting. This is from the Atlantic magazine, and figures are from 2004 to 2013. And if you look here, this one is for refugees by country of origin. You'll see Afghanistan and Syria take a big chunk. That's where we're getting, of course, a lot of our refugees. And then, of course, our African countries, Somalia, Sudan, and DRC is Democratic Republic of the Congo. And then other countries are mixed in at that 38%. And then in the other graph there, these are the internally displaced persons I mentioned earlier by country. And so, you know, often we forget about, you know, other crises going on in the world, like in Colombia. Of course, though, we still have several there from the African countries and Syria. So I just thought that was a good visual. A quote from that article I'm going to read to you all. It says, "If it seems like the world is getting more violent at the moment, that's not just an illusion. The indexes and metrics suggest that the world has become less peaceful over the last 8 years after a sustained period of improved stability after the Cold War." So this isn't meant to depress us, but just to kind of remind us that we do have power. We can make small changes and things that we can do here to help build a more peaceful society. And one very important thing coming up, of course, is our election. And just in our own homes and in our own circles, we can certainly make a difference. And I wish I could find a more updated graph here, but this was the most recent I could find. I think it was dated, this is for the years 2013 through 2014. This is where refugees are being resettled now. So if you look at the hot pink or the fuchsia color there, Montana, Wyoming, Arkansas, Mississippi, these are at the bottom level, less than 6 refugees per 100,000 residents over 2 years. Time period. And then in the green, the darker green, that's the top 20% of states that are resettling. And you'll see that Kentucky is one of them, Washington, Idaho. Why do you think California and Florida are toward the lower end? Anybody want to take a guess?
Is there such a large population base to start with?
Yeah, that's a good point. More immigrants, yeah. It surprises me a little bit about Florida just because there are so many Cuban refugees, but they might not be coming over as the fully refugee status, I'm not sure. But I just thought this was interesting, and it really is interesting to me where people end up, and you see it here in Bowling Green, different pockets of different countries and ethnic groups. For example, in Dearborn, Michigan, there's a high population of Iraqis. and I believe it's in Minneapolis, Minnesota, a very high percentage of Somalis, or at least Minnesota in general. And then you'll see, I saw this article from Broken Sidewalk, Kentucky among top states welcoming refugees. Louisville lands in the international spotlight. And this is a great picture. I don't know if you all are familiar. There, Kentucky Refugee Ministries in Louisville has a program where people can donate bikes, and then they refurbish them if need be, and then they give them to refugees. So that's one of the biggest challenges, not only in learning a language, but just transportation. It's so difficult. And then they need transportation to get jobs. So if we can at least provide bikes, because that's another thing that they have to go through, get their driver's license. And if they don't have very strong language, that's another problem. So that's a very creative way that they've been helping. Have you ever heard of, or have people ever asked you, you know, why does Kentucky seem to have so many refugees? Well, partly because we have these three great organizations that are resettling refugees. These are official resettlement agencies, Catholic Charities, Kentucky Refugee Ministries, not only based in Louisville, but they also have a satellite office in Lexington, and they help serve a little bit of northern Kentucky, too. And then you have right here in Bowling Green. Do you all, are you familiar with the International Center? If not, check it out. They are based here in Bowling Green, and then they also have a satellite office in Owensboro. Let me show you a little more stats about the International Center. So this information is true of most official refugee agencies, but I just wanted to put your attention here because it's here in Bowling Green. Of course, as I mentioned, they're headquartered here, and they've been active since 1979, I think officially since 81. I've already mentioned the satellite office. Since their beginnings, they have resettled over 10,000 refugees. Since the mid-1990s, the greatest refugee populations have been from Bosnia, like our Merzet here, and Burma, Myanmar, and we've also had significant influxes from Cuba and Iraq. And this is according to KOR, CORE, Kentucky Office for Refugees. So do you all know of any other groups we might be missing that you all are familiar with? Have you met any Cubans, Iraqis?
The first one, Southeast Asians.
Southeast Asians, yes. And a lot of these are Burmese, yeah. I wonder if you have many Bhutanese, because we do in Louisville.
A lot of Central Americans, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Spanish, a lot of Spanish. Uh-huh.
Pacific Islanders as well.
Okay, great. See, it's so interesting to me, the different people. And in fact, I was having dinner earlier, and we were talking about up in northern Kentucky, there was one pastor, a Burmese man, and they started out with just 15 people there, and in just, I think, a year or two's time, word got out, this great pastor's there, and he has a congregation now of 300. So it's just word of mouth and how people settle. It's very interesting. I'll let you all read through some of these. I might note some of these types of services that these agencies provide. Of course, food, clothing, safe housing when they arrive, community and cultural orientation, job placements, very important, helping them find jobs, the English classes, even helping them enroll in schools for their children, trips to medical appointments. I mean, you can imagine every need that you would have if you don't know anything about a culture and you go somewhere else, just about everything you need help with, even PTSD referrals. And I wanted to point out the last one, assistance in reaching self-sufficiency in 180 days. That's not long. They're given very limited help, assistance, and then within that amount of time, they're pretty much, okay, you're on your own. That's why it's so important for schools and students and church groups to kind of help pick up where these agencies leave off.
What is amazing about that, though, is so many are coming with languages that we are not familiar with. And when we accepted the number of Burmese in our parish, there were three languages there from Burma, and we did not know A, B, and C.
Yeah.
It was like just struggling with human need.
Yes.
Eventually, it worked.
Yeah.
And we don't, it's like a miracle.
It is. That, yes. And as I was telling you at dinner, just, you know, it's amazing the things that you can communicate without knowing the same language, which have to do a song and dance sometimes and lots of pictures and lots of gestures, but usually you get your
point. Now we have the Burmese priest.
Oh, great.
We also have the Burmese bishop come over and see the need provided them.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's critical. If you can find an interpreter, it's, of course, there's nothing better than that. But especially, you know, just the legalese of things and the social services and how to explain about green cards and things. It's just, yeah, very challenging. So as I mentioned earlier, they have expected to be self-sufficient within 6 months of their arrival. So that means having a job and or get enrolled in school, learning the new language, or being fairly proficient at it by that point. Not easy. Not easy things we're asking of them. And they're also, refugees are eligible to become citizens within 5 years of living in the U.S. And these are three of my students. This is Lazaro and Milagros. They're in the book, and they're from Cuba. And this is them studying for their citizenship test, which was a big component of what we did at my elder program with KRM and Catholic Charities. It was to help them with all the questions and to know them frontward and backward so they could pass this test. Then you have Goma over here. Goma is from Bhutan, and I love that she's wearing her traditional dress there, and she was one of my first Bhutanese friends, and that's her just after the ceremony, holding her flag and her certificate. So it is an amazing time for them. Has anybody ever sat in on a naturalization ceremony? Have you? Isn't it just amazing? One time I had an Iraqi sitting next to me, and she's like, Amy, it's like the whole world is here. And I was like, I know, and who would have thought that they're right here among us, here to share their stories. So that's just a wonderful time for them. They're very proud to get that citizenship. Now, we're not going to run this video. We were having a little technical difficulties earlier. But if you get a chance, please check out, you could just, you know, Google YouTube and Flavors from Home video. And I'll have some quotes from some of my people that I interviewed. And it has a great little song. Does anybody know Appalachian? Not Appalachian. Oh, I forgot the name of their group, but he was in my class, and so they're great. They fuse Appalachian music with Latin American music. It's very good. And this is an example of some of the Bhutanese women that I taught and that were an inspiration for this book. This was at our last World Refugee Day. It's usually in June. This was last year's. I always have a funny story. One of the ladies that I used to teach, we'd just been out on break, and she's 80 years old. God love her. You know, she's still sitting here trying to learn a new language. And so we had to kind of settle down and get back to work. And she, you know, I said, okay. Kalamaya was her name. I said, okay, Kalamaya, go ahead and sit. And she came over to me, and she's like, I don't want to study. I want to dance. And this picture always reminds me of them. I'm like, I know. I'm with you. So, very cute. This is Amina Osman. She is from Somalia, and she is a Somali Bantu. And they are one of the most persecuted ethnic groups in the world. And this is her proudly displaying some of the produce that she grew from her refugee garden. In Louisville, we have what we call RAP program, Refugee Agricultural Partnership Program, and I think they're up to 9 gardens now, and these are just for the refugees. And so many refugees, that was their livelihood, is to farm, particularly the Bantus are a farming community. So she told me that it just feels like she's back home when she can get into the garden like this. She is one of their success stories of the program because she now sells at farmers markets, and she also sells to some of the, you know, higher upper end restaurants on East Market in the Nulu area in Louisville. So this is a way that she not only can do what she loves, kind of gets back to her roots from her homeland, but also supplements her income, and they can get a lot of money this way, or at least enough to support them and their family. So that's a great story there. Okay, this is, I mentioned Dr. Galali Wali Khan earlier. This is her. This is our one of the few Pakistani female surgeons. And now she's working at Kentucky Refugee Ministries. One of the unfortunate things, and I think it was in the case of Mirzette too, a lot of times they cannot do some of these occupations that they trained for in their own countries, like doctors and lawyers and mechanical engineers. So they have to start out with whatever they can and do whatever jobs they can. can. That said, I can't think of a single time that I've ever heard them complain about that. They are just usually so thankful for the jobs that they've had, even if it's, you know, wherever it might be, whatever entry level, packing, whatever. They're just happy to be in America and having a job. But this is biryani, not biryani, like a lot of people might be familiar with, like the Iraqi dish or Indian dish. This is a layered eggplant and yogurt, and there's a little bit of curry and cilantro on top. It's delicious. And I believe it was her mother's grandmother who gave her this recipe, and I believe she was in a royal family in Afghanistan. And where she is in the Peshawar Valley in Pakistan, it's right on the Afghanistan border. So that's just to kind of show you how many times the cuisine crosses the borders. And that's a delicious dish, very easy to make. Now, this is Coco Tran. Has anybody ever been it's in Louisville, Roots or Heart and Soy? They're sister restaurants right beside each other. They're in the Highlands off of Barstown Road. Well, if you ever go, check it out. It's a vegetarian restaurant. Delicious, though. But she is truly a success story. These are her spring rolls and peanut dipping sauce. And if I can make this, anybody can make this. But it's... she told me this was not her trade back in Vietnam. She was one of the original boat people that came over right after the fall of Saigon in 1975, I believe. And she said when she used to make rice, she'd burn it. And now she's one of the most successful restaurateurs in Louisville. So it just goes to show you the amazing persistence that they have in reaching their goals. She first went to a McDonald's. That was the first restaurant she ever went to in Louisville when she got to America. And she observed what was going on, and she said, I could do this. I could do this with my cuisine. And then she kept that in the back of her mind for I don't know how many years, finally found somebody who would partner with her. There you go. And she's opened now over 5 restaurants, and they've all been very successful. Yeah. She's a dear lady. One of the things that I love about Coco is the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, every year now for I don't know how many years, she will open up her doors to anybody for a free meal. It's delicious. And then if you want, you could give her a donation, and then she'll take that money and she'll divide it out among charities in Louisville. So this is just one example of how much they want to give back. And once they are on their feet, they just truly want to make a difference and to give back to what her community did for her. And this is one of my favorite names to say, Abdiaziz and his wife, Hafsa. This is their Dulcho Subag, and it's a butter cake. And it just goes to show you, who would think butter cake, you know, in Somalia. But this is one of the, we think, came over from the colonization time from England. Especially there's pound cakes, and it could have also been from American butter cakes, a little more popular. So that's interesting, and it's very good. I remember when I was with them, the first time I met this family, they were in northern Kentucky. They said, well, we usually just sit on the floor when we eat. And I said, that's perfect. I want to eat. When in Rome, I want to eat how you all eat. And it was one of the best lunches I've ever had. It was very simple, but we all just sat around and simple meal, but it was really delicious and one of my fond memories of doing the book. Ah, does this look familiar, Merced? And no, that's not a cocktail he's holding in his hand. That's what I first thought. It's a butter for their lapina. This is the bread, and this is cevapi, a Bosnian sausage, and it's usually a mix of several meats, beef, pork, lamb. It's best when it can be a combination of meats, right? And they often serve it with sour cream, onions on the side. Grilled is important, charcoal, right? But he does a great job with these. And Merzec started the Bosnian Club, or was very instrumental in starting the Bosnian Club. What year was it, Merzec? I forget.
What?
20 years, wow. So it was very important for Merzec and his Bosnian culture to protect that culture. And they first started, you know, to protect that culture, the education, the sports, those things, but also to help share and educate with the community what their life was like and how it's been to assimilate in America. And one of the things I love, I don't know if you can see there on his shirt, the Bosnian Club emblem is part American flag and part the old Bosnian flag. Yeah, so I think that's a really cool image of him there. And remember when I mentioned the gentleman from Bhutan who had to leave in his pajamas? This is Kamalapati Subedi from Bhutan, and he's holding his personalized copy of Flavors from Home. That was one of my best moments after the book, as I negotiated with my publisher to make sure all my contributors could get a free copy. And so that was to me the most rewarding thing, is to give them their copy. And also when I get to have book talks like this, if I am blessed enough to have one of my refugees join me, I love to have them sign their name on their story too, because this book wouldn't be without them. So thank you again. And then this is again Kamalapati's family. They're making momos. Has anybody ever had a momo? Yeah, what do you have? So this is a Nepalese dumpling, and they like to do theirs vegetarian. It's so delicious with ginger and cabbage and all kinds of spices, and then they usually dip it with a hot tomato dipping sauce. Very good, and that's in my book as well. And this is just, I said, are you sure y'all aren't doing this just for show, just because I'm here with a camera? But no, they say at least a couple times a month they cook big meals like this together. And it's just interesting. You see Kamalapati there with his topi. That's what they call the gentleman's hat there. But then you can see the difference already in the change of dress, how the younger generations aren't wearing their native dress. So it'll be interesting to see how they adapt and change. I kind of miss the old ways. So this is them cooking. And now it's your turn. I always like to ask this. If someone asked you for your favorite recipe from your homeland, a dish that brings you comfort, what would it be? And I know this doesn't look very appetizing, but these are three of my favorites. I have a lot of German heritage on both sides of my family. So German potato salad, my mom makes a great one. She makes a great Derby pie too. We got Derby just around the corner. And then I love anything with cheese, but the cheesy grits, love that. So those kind of are some of my, it's really hard to choose though. I have so many favorites. But that is what I asked my contributors. I didn't want to be too prescriptive about it. I simply said, you know, give me something that's fairly representative of your homeland, a dish, but also something that when you make it here in your American kitchen, it makes you feel closer to home. Because in many ways, their food and being able to cook their native foods here in America, one of the few lifelines that they have to their home countries. No one's asking them to change their ways, their native foods. That is something they can do behind the scenes in their own homes. And for the most part, with availability of ingredients, ethnic ingredients that there are these days, even to order online, they can do that with relative ease. And I know even here in Bowling Green, you all have lots of ethnic restaurants as well as grocery stores. So then it was just interesting to see the different things that I got from that. And some did give a more traditional or national dish. I think Mirzet's chivapi is an example of that. And others, just like I think the Burani dish that Galale Wali Khan contributed, that one is more central to her family. Can anybody give me an example of something that you all might choose? Yeah. Oh, okay, explain.
It's a spicy, I guess, soup. You usually serve breakfast. Well, I guess not. Usually breakfast. Beef tripe.
It says Mexican?
Yes.
Yeah.
Beef tripe and hominy. It's usually served with raw onions and lime or lemon.
Ooh.
And salting crackers and stuff.
See, no, just thinking about it. Doesn't it make you like miss home? I know.
Mostly improved virility, they just tell us.
It's actually a hangover thing.
Oh, well, it has lots of uses, that one.
It's supposed to be the cure for it, you know.
Yeah.
That's not why I remember.
Sure, sure.
How do you spell it?
M-E-N-U-D-O. Okay.
Not to be confused with the
important. Not
the boy band. The boy band, right. That's what I thought.
Yeah.
Okay. What about anybody else? When you think of some of your favorite, and it could be from a different, even though you're born in America, it could be like my German potato salad, something from your ethnic heritage. Yes.
Well, I'm an Ashkenazi Jew, so Jewish deli foods and foods like blintzes, and even though they're not actually
specifically Jewish. They're really from Eastern and Central Europe.
Uh-huh.
But...
That's true to your heritage, though, yeah. Oh, good. Good ones. Yeah.
Corned beef and cabbage.
Corned beef and cabbage. I've heard that one before. Yeah, that's good.
I'm a Kentucky native. I have to go with fried chicken and hot browns.
Oh, yes, and hot brown, of course, the Louisville. Yes.
Well, I was originally from New Orleans and got several different recipes that I learned from my mother, gumbo, and a few other things.
Oh.
But I was also, for 17 years, I was married to an Italian who's very small for both.
Oh, wow.
I have learned probably do Italian meatballs for spaghetti and a sauce. When I cook the sauce, it's cooked no less 18 hours, 24 hours.
And see, that's what you find, that the best dishes like that just are very time consuming because everything's made from scratch. It's just, was there a hand over here? Yeah.
With my parents being from Orange Squirrel, and of course going down there many times, it would be barbecue.
Oh, yes. Yes. Very true to Owensboro.
What did you say?
Burgoo. Yeah.
I actually have a multi-generational fried chicken recipe. My great-grandmother handed it to her daughter, and she taught my mother how to make it. And my mother taught me. I've added a few pieces to it, and I passed it to my daughters.
And that was a wonderful thing about cooking, because I was truly learning how your grandmother would pass it down, or, you know, looking over their shoulders is exactly, because very few of them, unless they were a cook themselves that had a restaurant, had a handwritten recipe. So that was probably the most challenging part of the book, is trying to capture every little spice. And of course, they don't use measuring cups, don't use measuring spoons, so I'm like having to bring my own, and they're like, oh no, you know, because they don't want to cook that way. And I don't prefer to cook that way either. I like a little bit of this and a little bit of that, but for the purposes of the book, I really had to give something, and that was kind of hard to explain to them, but they were good-natured about it. But yeah, and then sometimes I would make something, and I couldn't get it quite right at home in my own test kitchen. By the way, there's 42 recipes, and I did test every one of them. But I'd run back, you know, and I'd go, something happened. What? They'd make it a completely different way, as your grandma might do. And so that, again, that was the challenging aspect of this. Did you have, yeah, Daniel?
No, it's actually more of my wife, because I grew up on the West Coast.
And that's a Southern thing.
West Coast, it's not even an option.
Yeah.
Breakfast tables, if you do find it, it's like three or four tacos.
Uh-huh.
Where's that?
Yeah, where's the line, right, that divides that? Yeah, yeah.
Originally, I came from China, so, you know, dumplings from here.
Yes.
I think I can make one of the best.
See, this is making me want to have like a mini potluck right now. Just everybody bring their dish.
Yeah, all kinds of Chinese. You use like a garlic chives, or vegetable, or a cabbage, or even dill.
Yeah.
And of course,
dumplings. Oh.
And also, there's a trick. We can use the American thing, so the Chinese cooking. You know the biscuits?
Yeah.
I can use those dough and wrap the stuffing, steam them, and get the dumplings.
Oh, that's a little trick. Yeah, shortcut. I like it. Okay. Well, I know we're running out of time here, but thank you all for sharing those. Might make you think of some. Maybe you'll go home and make one of those dishes. I also wanted to mention that there's 23 stories total. It took about 2.5 years to write, and then maybe another year of the editing and that process. But there's about 13 different countries represented, and I actually have 4 Burmese, and you all have mentioned you have quite a few Burmese here. And the part of that reasoning was because there's over 135 ethnic groups in Burma. So it's a very, I wanted to get the different ethnicities that we have a lot of here that are resettling in Kentucky, and the Chin group is one of them. Some of the countries represented: Azerbaijan, Bhutan, Bosnia, Burma, which is now goes by officially Myanmar, Cuba, DRC, Hungary, Iran, Iraq, Pakistan, Rwanda, Somalia, Vietnam. So that gives you a large range. when I was writing this book, we didn't have many, if any, Assyrians coming in at that time. So unfortunately, I don't have a Assyrian represented, but that just goes to show you that's how things would change if somebody were to write this again. I started in the 1950s with the Hungarian Revolution. That was the first person that I track, and then I go all the way to, I think it's about 2012. But it is interesting to just watch the progression. You can kind of see all the different crises and the what's happening in the world by how they resettled and relocated here. And so so far, over 1,000 copies sold. So for a small press, University Press of Kentucky, they tell me that's good. And so it's supposed to go to paperback in next year, which I'm very happy about. And I forgot to mention, too, part of the proceeds go back to the refugee resettlement agencies, which was very important for me, to do. And I feel good about giving back to the refugees like Merzette that I interviewed. And I want that money to go back and help continue to help. Does anybody have any questions? Well, I'll just have everybody, hopefully you'll buy a copy and you can read these inspiring stories, but I also want to make sure you all have time to have a dessert.
Questions?
When did you say you started the book? What period?
It was probably around late 2011, 2012, yeah, early 2012, yeah.
I was just curious over how much time the story.
Right, yeah. And I tell you, it is the cooking that took the longest. Of course, I love writing stories, so that part was easy for me. But so anybody else over here had a yeah?
Do you pick people from your classes, or how did you find people?
That's a great question. Yeah, probably, I don't know, maybe five or so are actual students, or were students. But the other ones, I have to say, the refugee agencies, including the one here in Bowling Green, were very helpful in pinpointing people, because I kind of came to them, this is my idea, we need somebody who likes to cook at least, or good cook, and someone who knows at least enough English or has an interpreter that we can communicate, and someone who doesn't mind sharing their story. And, you know, I hated to include just somebody with a powerful story, because just about every refugee has a powerful story, but there were some that really stood out than others. So that's kind of how, and I also did my own research, and that, you know, Coco Tran is one I found on my own, and Merzette, actually doing some research, somebody recommended Merzette in this area, so I kind of found you on my own. So yeah.
Other questions back here?
Outside of America and Western Europe, what are some of the 12 countries that do accept refugees?
Oh, yeah, Canada, England, Australia. Those are ones that come to mind. But, yeah, I think I read somewhere there's just about 13 or 14. It might be slowly increasing, especially with the Syrian crisis. There might be more now accepting. That might be an old stat. But, yeah, Canada does a good job with that. Yeah.
We were talking at supper about the original American. Have you ever thought of going into the Indian community and finding something that was dominantly Indian, American Indian?
Like Native American?
Yeah, like Native American.
Yeah. Are you suggesting another book, Peggy?
Yes, I am.
That would be interesting, yeah.
It just seems like, you know, you're so enthusiastic about what you have done here.
Mm-hmm.
I think you do a great job if you move into that, because we couldn't figure out anything but the chocolate chip cookie.
Yeah, I know. It's like, what is truly an American dish?
Yeah,
think about it. It's not easy, because we all come from a melting pot. Yeah.
One more question.
Thank you.
And before we start handing out some of these lovely desserts. Well, hearing none then, hope you'll join with me in thanking our speaker.
Thank you, guys. Thanks for coming out again.
On behalf of our friends of library organization, a little token of our appreciation.
Oh, thank you.
And then the big prize of the night, a copy of Amy's book. I'll let Amy hold that, and
yay,
we'll do. And Inma Pertusa, Dr. Pertusa.
Yay!
Well, thank you all for coming. We're getting desserts ready as we speak. We'll hope you'll come and join us. Merzette is here if you'd like to chat with him. We'll be getting Amy set up if you'd like to get a copy of the book. And we thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.